Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Are you a former Democrat? Are you one of those who, a Christian, who said, look, I used to be a Democrat because, you know, I believe it was a working man's party. And it looked out for the little guy. It looked out for the guy like me, Mr. Lunch Pail. And for a long time, that was my politics. But then the party left me. It abandoned me. And worse than that, it became hostile to my Christian beliefs, to my religion. Or maybe you're still a Democrat and you're struggling in that very position with your political party. We're going to talk about the Democratic Party and traditional believers, and I want to hear from you during this hour as we talk to Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. James Hitchcock is senior editor of Touchstone magazine, and he's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone titled Political Orphans: How the Democratic Party Left Traditional Believers Behind. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, I'm always glad to be here.
Let's trace the history of this if we could. Have I oversimplified the case? Democratic Party once kind of the bastion of the little guy, the working man. When did the change take place, in particular vis-a-vis traditional believers?
Well, I'd say the crucial time came in the late 60s. Some people may remember the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 68, where you had large numbers of people outside the halls protesting the war, etc. And you had Mayor Daley's policemen breaking up these demonstrations. It was a deep split within the party. The Democrats lost that year. By 72, when they nominated Senator George McGovern, the left wing of the party, you might say, had essentially won. And they have run things ever since. For example, the labor movement, for a while, when George Meany was president of the AFL-CIO, was very conservative on social issues. They were not pro-abortion. They were, you might say, somewhat hawkish on foreign policy and so on. But they were kind of pushed aside, too. The Democratic Party is now predominantly, I'd say, the party of feminists, the party of upper middle class people who may think of themselves kind of as intellectuals. It's not the working man's party anymore.
And how did this change take place? You mentioned the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and I'm thinking in particular about the attendant cultural revolution that was meeting its height in 1968.
Right. Well, the exact mechanics of it, I'm not quite sure how it took place. A lot of it was behind the scenes politicking. But I think there's this thing, the kind of people we're talking about, if you say, for example, militant feminists, these are people with a very, very high degree of determination, and they work very, very, very hard for what they want. They do not take no for an answer. And I think they just pushed and pushed until they got what they wanted. In addition, they manipulated, I would say, the consciences of a lot of people in the party. The Democrats think of themselves as being the party of the victim, the party of the underdog. So if you then position yourself as an underdog and you say, what about me? It's kind of difficult for the typical liberal to reject your appeal. And so I think that's what also tended to happen.
Now, you know, someone's going to say, look, what the Democratic Party did was simply follow through on what it was only doing partially in its early days, and that is it sought to be the party for the little guy and for the working man, and all it did was expand the base there to draw in all the underdogs, all the little people. How would you respond to that?
Well, there's some truth to that. The Democratic Party, of course, has become the party of African Americans, who are clearly underdogs. Interesting thing there is African Americans are much more conservative on what we might call the social issues than are white people. They're much more likely to be anti-abortion, much more likely to go to church. Somehow or other, that's not reflected in their political behavior, where they seem to approach the Democratic Party primarily in economic terms. But then you turn around and take feminists, who in many ways are the key group. It's a stretch, I think, to view them as the underdog, because the most active feminists tend to be upper middle class, well-off women with careers and certainly no economic wants. It was just by their insisting that they were victims that they got themselves accepted as such. And then, of course, the great looming question, are the unborn not victims as well?
All right. Without overgeneralizing, this is going to be difficult to do, but how generally would you say the Democratic Party today, how has it positioned itself in relationship to the issue of religion, in particular, Orthodox Christianity?
A very interesting statistic that came out recently was in a scholarly journal called The Public Interest. Those people in our society who are not religious, who claim that they have no religious belief, they don't belong to a church, would profess themselves to be atheists or agnostics, will overwhelmingly vote Democratic. And there's a very high degree of correlation between being extremely active in a church and voting Republican. That has come about, I think, only in relatively recent years. I don't think that would have been true even, say, 20 years ago. Right now, I mean, we can't separate, of course, some of the moral issues from this. Right now, it's the Democrats in Washington who are doing everything they can conceivably do to prevent men or women from being appointed to the courts whom they suspect might be opposed to abortion. If you take the extreme court decisions which have banned prayer and so forth from public places, schools, it's overwhelmingly, again, Democrats who have supported this. The Republicans have picked up that issue along the way and generally advocate that there should be more room for religion in the public sphere.
You mentioned the court. What role have the courts, and in particular the Supreme Court, played in shaping this, what it sounds like, animosity in general toward religion in the Democratic Party?
Well, the Supreme Court is, of course, the crucial agency which is able to enforce this. And here I do have to enter a caution. It's not true that every justice appointed by a Republican president turns out to be friendly to religion. There have been some notable exceptions to that, most currently Justice David Souter on the Supreme Court. So the Republican Party is not such an overwhelmingly reliable friend, you might say, to religious interests. But I think they have learned perhaps from some of their past mistakes. And I think they are certainly much more reliable institutionally as the Democrats. It would be inconceivable for the Democrats to appoint someone to the court who was known to be an intensely religious person whose beliefs were shaped by that and who would say, frankly, you know, I think religion has a legitimate place in the public sphere.
You cite two post-World War II Supreme Court cases, Everson in 1947 and McCollum in 1948, in what kind of legally solidifying the notion of separation of church and state. Tell us about that.
Well, there had been no such decisions prior to 1947, even though we're often told that that was the meaning of the Constitution from the beginning. In 47, they actually allowed some very minor aid to be given to students in religious schools, bus fare. But they laid down on that same occasion the philosophy of absolute separation of church and state, which is not what the Founding Fathers held. The following year, the McCollum case, they struck down what's called release time, which is that kids, students would be allowed at certain times of the day in public schools to go into different classrooms and receive instructions in their particular faith. That was the beginning of the policy, which has continued more or less to the present with some modification. Of being very suspicious of religion in the public sphere, wanting to push religion out, establishing in effect a kind of a secular public square, as it's sometimes been called.
If the Founding Fathers did not hold to the absolute separation of church and state, as you read the documents, the founding documents and their opinions, to what did they hold?
There was not complete agreement among them. I would say Thomas Jefferson probably did hold to something close to what the modern court says, but Jefferson was quite clearly in a minority. First of all, he was not involved in drafting the Constitution. He was on a diplomatic mission to France. And from the very beginning, we find constant interaction between religion and the government. We have, of course, chaplains in the military. We have chaplains in the legislature. We have the Indian schools were placed under the direction of clergy from the very beginning. We had any number of things. The long list goes on and on and on, indicating that this was not the way most of the founding fathers saw it. And we have just a sudden radical 180-degree reversal occurring in 1947.
We're talking with Dr. James Hitchcock about the Democratic Party and traditional believers. He's professor of history at St. Louis University, senior editor of Touchstone magazine, and author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone titled Political Orphans, How the Democratic Party Left Traditional Believers Behind. If you are a former Democrat who believes that the party has abandoned you, or a present-day Democrat who's struggling with these issues, give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'd like to hear from you. What role did Franklin Roosevelt, his long presidency, and in particular the New Deal, play in the reshaping of the Democratic Party vis-a-vis religion?
It's a complicated question. Roosevelt himself was what I would call a conventional Episcopalian. He was a believer. And in fact, it's been estimated that he mentioned God more frequently in his speeches than any other president. I don't think Franklin Roosevelt set out to establish this result. He did, however, appoint to the Supreme Court all the justices who brought about this revolution in 1947. There's a subtler connection here, and that is, it is really with the New Deal that the Democratic Party starts to become the party of the intellectuals, where you get people, especially from Ivy League schools, coming down to Washington. They've got great plans for revamping the entire nation. They don't have a whole lot of confidence in the wisdom of ordinary people because ordinary people don't see the big picture. And so it's from that point on that I say the intellectuals, who are mostly secular in their outlook, become an increasingly prominent element within the Democratic Party, and then that finally triumphs after 1968 with the McGovern campaign in 72.
You're really then talking about not just intellectuals, but the intellectual elites, aren't you?
Yes. Well, you know, how does one define that? I suppose a lot of people think of themselves as intellectuals, but what I mean by this is, you know, a lot of professors, lawyers who are not in private practice, but who are oriented towards public agencies, whereby they can bring about substantive change. And above all, it's the idea that you just can't let people alone to run their own lives. They either have to be helped because they are underdogs, they have to be guided in the right direction because they're not enlightened enough to see what it is they should be doing. And for example, why do we have abortion justified by the Supreme Court? Why not wait and let it up to the state legislatures? Well, an answer that often comes back is, well, people just aren't enlightened enough to realize that this ought to be a universal right. And so we can't rely upon state legislatures because people might just make the wrong decision.
Was there a point in this transition for the Democratic Party in its relationship with traditional believers, in particular, really Orthodox Christians, where the gap existed, where the party was clearly headed in the direction that was inimical to traditional Orthodox Christianity, but the vast majority of Democratic voters were still largely conservative and, I guess for lack of a better word, pious?
Well, I think it was a gradual thing. You know, it's worth recalling that beginning in 68, the Democrats didn't enjoy very much success with the White House. They were out of the White House for most of the next almost 30 years. And clearly it was having its toll, as many people recognized. And there was a definite shift during that time of people who had been measurably Democratic voters now moving into the Republican Party, or at least voting Republican. And the interesting thing here is I think that even when it has been demonstrated that the party has lost substantial support because of this, they do not change. They will not back down on the abortion issue. And I think that the people, for example, who now control the party would in many cases rather lose than have to change their position. It's often been said, and I think it's correct, that the one single belief that is required of every Democrat who hopes to hold any sort of national office, you must be pro-abortion. There is no room for anybody in at that level in the party who holds any other view on the subject. It's an amazing enforcement of orthodoxy.
Is abortion the one non-negotiable issue with the new Democratic Party?
I'd say it is. There are some others which may be just a bit less so. I think, for example, homosexual rights is coming to be non-negotiable. Here again, I think it's an unpopular issue for most people. But the party, I think, has so locked itself in to feminists, homosexuals, and people who are sympathetic, that there's almost no way of backing out now, even if they want to. Congressman Richard Gebhardt of Missouri, who is a candidate for the presidency, was a very active Baptist, and for many years was strongly anti-abortion. Then as soon as he announced that he was interested in the presidency, I forget when this was, maybe 10 years ago or so, does an absolute flip-flop on the abortion issue. And realizes that he's not going to go anywhere nationally unless he does so, and it's an indicative thing of how many Democrats view religion. When he explains his flip flop, he says, "Well, you see, I was raised a Baptist, and so I was taught that abortion was wrong, and so the implication is, well, this was an irrational belief. Then I grew up, I started to think for myself, and so I changed my mind." That seems to be the way a lot of Democrats view religion. It's sort of irrational, and when you start to think, then you'll really adopt a secular outlook.
All right. You mentioned before the overwhelming majority of African Americans in the country are voting Democratic. When did the shift to the Democratic Party begin for African Americans?
Well, I think it became a notable shift at the time of the New Deal with Franklin Roosevelt in the 30s, because prior to that time, the Democratic Party still had the image of having been the party of the South of the time of the Civil War. It was an even more rapid shift, of course, at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and I think if we're laying blame on parties, that the many Republicans back in the late 50s and early 60s very blindly and very unwisely opposed civil rights legislation, and the party got the image then of being anti-black. And if black voters voted, as I say, the social issues, they would tend to be Republicans. We could take Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court as a good example of this. But if they approach politics, as apparently they do in terms of government programs, economic aid, welfare, etc., then they overwhelmingly vote Democratic.
And how does that square and you've mentioned before that they are disapproving of abortion in higher proportions than whites. How does the black general opposition to abortion square with what we see from a lot of the brighter lights of the black Democratic movement, Jesse Jackson, Reverend Al Sharpton, who are unequivocally pro-choice?
It's a very difficult thing to figure out, but Jesse Jackson's an excellent example. He started out as being pro-life. And why did he change? I think that he changed because that's what the white liberals demanded. He realized that if he was going to be acknowledged as a black leader, quote, he had to have the approval of white liberals, and white liberals would never give him that approval as long as he was pro-life. The only explanation that I can think of the seeming contradictions is that, again, blacks tend to look at this for purely in economic terms. You know, they sort of, in effect, shut out the social issues when it comes to voting.
You have written this, and I'd like you to explain what it is you mean. For a time, a liberal stance on social issues was merely one of the numerous arrows in the Democratic quiver. But the heirs of the new left tend to be fanatics, both ruthless and politically skillful. What do you mean by that?
Well, it comes back again to our saying a few minutes ago that abortion is the one and non-negotiable issue, maybe along with homosexuality. There might have been a time when you would have had Democrats who would have said, well, I'm liberal about economics, but I'm conservative, I'm pro-life. And there are still a few around. So, in other words, it was a mixture of issues. That's what I mean by saying, you know, a multiplicity of arrows in the quiver. But it has been tightened up to the point that only very marginal public figures in the Democratic Party will dare to be pro-life. Abortion is again the one issue that is enforced orthodoxy, and you're not going to go very high in the party if you don't subscribe to that.
And yet, yeah, I think if in candid statements, if the bevy or the stable of Democratic presidential candidates who have presented themselves this early in the race for 2004 were to be asked, what do you think about religion? They'd have nothing but glowing things to say, it seems.
Oh, I'm sure they would. No one, you know, at this juncture, although I wouldn't bet on it 10 years from now, but no one at this juncture is going to attack religion. But then if you start asking them specific questions, well, do you favor religion having more of a role in the public sphere? Do you think there should be public aid to religious schools? What do you think about the right to pray in public in schools, for example? Do you think that religious beliefs, for example, on things like abortion ought to guide public figures? If you believe because of your religion that abortion is wrong, then ought you not to vote that way if you're in Congress? There, I think you're going to get most Democrats backing off and using the rhetoric of separation of church and state. A couple of Catholics are particularly notable in that regard. There's a Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, the former Governor Mario Cuomo of New York. I could go on with a long list. who will say, oh, I never allow my religion to influence my public policy. And that goes back to John F. Kennedy 40 years ago. And that has become almost just a kind of a slogan that Democratic politicians now recite.
Dr. Hitchcock, are you able to stay with us through the remainder of the hour?
Sure.
All right, thank you very much. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation on the Democratic Party and traditional believers with Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University, senior editor of Touchstone Magazine, and author of an article in the latest edition of Touchstone titled Political Orphans, How the Democratic Party Left Traditional Believers Behind. I'd like to hear from you if you are a former Democrat or a present Democrat struggling with these issues. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When your children ask you about the very first Easter, how do you go about telling them the story of Jesus' passion, death, and resurrection from the dead? What was it like to witness his suffering, his trials, and his crucifixion? These events stand at the very heart of the Christian faith, and they are beautifully retold in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, by Dr. Paul Meyer. You can order The Very First Easter by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can order The Very First Easter online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on The Very First Easter. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. 1-800-325-3040.
Eve, Even evolutionists talk about her.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the fascinating book on dinosaurs, The Great Dinosaur Mystery Solved. Now, Ken, why would evolutionists be interested in Eve, the first woman?
Well, it's fascinating. Over recent years, scientists have conducted a lot of research on DNA that's found in the mitochondria of a cell. Now, this DNA is only inherited through the females. By comparing mutations or mistakes in the DNA of people worldwide, scientists came to a startling conclusion. It looks as if all people living today are descended from one woman, and they called her Eve. Now, here's a startling new twist. Based upon mutation rates, scientists once claimed that this ancestral Eve lived hundreds of thousands of years ago. But a recent study claims that the rate of mutations in man is actually 20 times higher than originally estimated. So what does this mean? Using this new figure for mutation rates, the ancestral mother of all, as they call her, lived a mere 6,000 years ago. Of course, the evolutionary scientists don't accept this new figure, but isn't it remarkable that this research actually supports the Bible's teaching that there was a first woman, Eve, created about 6,000 years ago?
Were all land animals also created just 6,000 years ago? Or did it take millions of years? Ken Ham examines this crucial point in his new booklet on the 6 days of creation. It's available free on our website, answersradio.com.
:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, mostly cloudy tonight, low of about 39. For Tuesday, cloudy with a chance of rain in the afternoon, high near 47. Right now, partly cloudy and 54 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 is heavy and slow from Boyle to Hanley and crowded at Brentwood. Westbound 44, slow 270. In the right lane, eastbound 270 is slow McDonald to 170. Southbound 170 between Ladue and 40, there's some heavy traffic there. Eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, there's some slow traffic. And northbound 55 between 44 and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Craig Allen. Issues Etc. is next.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsors on this Monday, April 7th, 2003, Sue and Donald Hecht. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in celebration of Sue's birthday and Sue's mother-in-law, Grace Amanda Hecht's birthday. Once again, a very special thank you to Sue and Donald Hecht of St. Charles, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsors, and best wishes for a very happy birthday for both Sue and Grace.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking with Dr. James Hitchcock. Continuing our conversation, he has graciously agreed to stay with us for the remainder of the hour. We're talking about the Democratic Party and traditional believers. Tomorrow on the program, Democrats and Abortion, Nat Hentoff of the Village Voice will be our guest. We'll see what he has to say about Democrats and abortion. Also, the Trials of Jesus, Dr. Paul Meyer, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. The very first Easter will be our guest to talk about that, and part one of a four-part weekly series on understanding the end times with Kim Riddlebarger of the White Horse Inn. Now, our guest in this hour, Dr. James Hitchcock, says that the Democratic Party, slowly but surely over the last several decades, has abandoned traditional believers and taken up a posture of, well, almost hostility toward traditional believers. Do you agree or disagree with him? You can give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Hitchcock, something was made visually apparent to me in the last presidential election, and that was when it was displayed the garnering of votes county by county of the two Democratic of the two presidential candidates, and we all remember the big American map with the red and the blue states,
right?
Where the Democratic votes for presidential candidate and then Vice President Al Gore sat on the east and west coast predominantly, and in urban areas, and the counties that went for Republican George W. Bush sat in the middle of the country and in more rural areas. Is this another shift in the Democratic Party, in their emphasis, in their, or how does it reflect a shift in their emphasis?
Well, it does. I guess it does with both parties. Now, of course, it's people who are represented, not land. So the Democrats control, you might say, some of the more populous areas. But it's interesting that California, where Ronald Reagan, of course, was governor, and there have been conservative Republicans out there until fairly recently, but now, as far as I can see, California is completely gone over to the liberal side. What accounts for this, I don't really know, except that I think that any area of the country, and California is clearly one, where people have a very strong consciousness of themselves as, well, we're in the advance guard, you know, we're in the vanguard of progress. That's probably translated then into being a liberal Democrat. So you see, Massachusetts is that way, New York City is that way, where people don't put a lot of emphasis probably on traditional values. They see traditional values as something that you discard as you move your way through life. This is a surmise on my part, but it's the most plausible explanation I can think of.
Now, you pointed this out earlier in our conversation, but lest people say that this conversation is intended to say that the Republican Party is lily white and the natural home of Orthodox believers, you point out that the Roe Court, its prevailing opinion in 1973 was written by a Republican justice, Harry Blackmun.
I could give you a list of Republican justices who I think have done great mischief on the court, as they say, including right now Justice David Souter, who's probably, in my judgment, the most pernicious member of the court right now, and was appointed by the first President Bush. So yes, I don't want to be seen as giving a commercial for the Republican Party and say go blindly to the polls and push the Republican lever. For one thing, it's good for us if we find Democratic candidates who are sympathetic to what we're trying to do, we should by all means support them, because the best thing that could happen would be if the two parties were competing for our vote. If the Republicans think of us as religious believers as being a they've got us locked up, then they don't really have to pay too much attention to us. There are in public life today Republicans who are no different from Democrats on these kinds of things. And there's an element in the Republican Party, we're sometimes disparagingly referred to as country club Republicans, who resent what they see as a kind of a takeover of the party by conservative believers. And it's like, well, what have you done? You've come in, we had a real nice party here, and you came and took it over. So there are those factors to be borne in mind.
Now, let's talk about mainline liberal Protestant churches and the degree to which they have, become the servant of this movement, not only a hostility toward traditional believers in the Democratic Party, but all the other deviant moral issues as well.
Absolutely. If this were an issue here of church members versus non-church members, it would be no contest, because the number of people who regard themselves as having no religion at all and agnostics and so on is very small, although it is growing. There used to be a joke that the Episcopal Church was the Republican Party at prayer. Well, whatever that joke might have meant years ago, it's certainly very far from the truth today. The Episcopal Church is just one example of a mainline church which is very predictably liberal on every conceivable public issue. The National Council of Churches is very predictably liberal on every conceivable public issue. Some of the almost hysterical warnings about religion intruding itself into the public sphere have come from liberal clergy, and it's the wrong theology that they did battle in their own denominations with Orthodox theology. They won those fights, and now it's bothersome to them. the same shift of people, you know, conservative believers moving from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, you can see the same thing, of course, as you know, happening in the churches. The old mainline churches have been losing members over a period of decades, and the more conservative churches have been growing.
So if there is a religious right, no one's going to deny this, of course, whatever that might be.
Right.
Is there also a religious left?
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the ways in which the media have falsified the situation is they never refer to that. Let's just take the war right now that's going on. Well, you know, it doesn't break down. Supporter opposition doesn't break down neatly in terms of theological or religious beliefs. You have people on both sides. But the mainline churches, the liberal religious leaders, have been almost unanimous in their opposition to the war. That's their right. If they think that's correct, they should do it. But they're never dubbed the religious left. You know, no one ever says in the mainstream media, no one ever says the religious left is against this war. Similarly, they don't say that about abortion or homosexual rights or any of these things.
All right, then, if we have a liberal religious left and a religious right, is it accurate to simply equate those with Democratic Party religious left, Republican Party religious right?
Well, it wouldn't be absolutely equatable, but insofar as those two groups are interested in politics, it pretty well tends to break down that way. Again, there are some liberal Republicans, and they probably get some support from the religious left, and there are a diminishing number of socially conservative Democrats, and they probably get some support from the religious right, but by and large, that is the way it breaks down.
Then Vice President and presidential candidate Al Gore spoke during the 2000 presidential election, and talked about taking God back from the Republicans' grip. Those were not his words, but he did talk about taking God back. What did he mean, and how successful was that effort?
Well, I think what he meant was the very strong effort by the religious right, if we want to use that term, to say, look, these are religious, these are our beliefs. The Democratic Party's not sympathetic to our beliefs. We're going to try to work through the Republican Party to bring about a respect for our beliefs. He's, you know, saying, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a Baptist. President Clinton is a Baptist. We resent the fact that this accusation has been made. But the problem is, I always put it this way, take abortion as an example again. Historically, the great religions have opposed abortion, and it's a very sharp division now between religious believers and non-believers, although interestingly you're going to have a pro-life atheist on tomorrow, I understand it, Matt Hinhoff. But clearly, if you say I'm against abortion, it probably designates you as being a religious believer. What position does someone on the religious left take that is distinctively religious? How would someone on the religious left approach any issue any differently from the way a liberal atheist would approach it? And I think the answer is not at all. The religious left primarily is a cheerleader for movements which are really secular in origin. Feminism is an excellent example.
Well, now, so that we paint with the brush that paints both sides of the fence, would you be willing also to say that in some ways, kind of mainline pop American evangelicalism is sometimes the running boy for the religious right?
Yes, I probably don't know enough about mainline evangelicalism to say. I have from time to time encountered situations where people are so strongly convinced that that their values are supported by the Republican Party or by conservative politicians that they sort of blindly follow what the party says or what the conservative politician says and don't exercise sufficient critical judgment. How common that is, I don't know. Now, there are evangelicals, just as there are Catholics. Catholics who sort of pride themselves on being Democrats, and how they resolve that for themselves, I don't know.
We were talking about then Vice President Al Gore. He has recently written, along with his wife Tipper, a book called Joined at the Heart, which was probably had the biggest PR campaign of any book that did as poorly as his book did in recent history. But it was portrayed, at least in the media, as being a very pro-family, pro-traditional values book. What did it actually turn out to be?
Well, very different from that, and I think that's an excellent illustration. The family, as it turns out, when the Gores are finished with it, is pretty much any group of people who have some sort of personal relationship with one another. So they want to include homosexual couples. They want to include people living together who aren't married. They would even stretch it, I think, to include what used to be called communes, you know, people getting together and living in little communities all in the same house. It's a deliberate attempt to redefine the family. And, of course, the Democrats have taken a number of hits on that because of being so pro-homosexual and so forth has clearly given them an image of being anti-family. But I think in the very effort to say, well, we're pro-family too, the Gores are proving the opposite.
We're talking with Dr. James Hitchcock. He is professor of history at St. Louis University, senior editor of Touchstone magazine, and author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone titled Political Orphans: How the Democratic Party Left Traditional Believers Behind. Here's the website for Touchstone magazine, by the way. It's touchstonemag.com. touchstonemag, all one word, .com. Or you can subscribe to Touchstone by calling the Fellowship of St. James toll-free at 1-877-375-7373. That's toll-free, 1-877-375-7373. Ask to receive Touchstone magazine. The website address again, touchstonemag.com. Dr. Hitchcock, you talk about a soft utopia that is presented by the Democratic Party and the religious left. What is it?
The soft utopia is, or I sometimes would call it soft totalitarianism, is the belief that more and more areas of human life should really be controlled and regulated comprehensively by the government. It comes back again to this notion that ordinary people, in the end, probably aren't competent to handle their own affairs. So it has to do, of course, a great deal with education, how children are going to be raised and educated. And increasingly, there is a body of liberal opinion. It's still not quite on the popular radar screen, but it will get there, which is saying that parents are not the ultimate decision makers as far as the welfare of their children are concerned. Even people raising philosophical questions, do parents have a right to raise their children in an outmoded religious system? Are they harming their children if they teach their children, for example, that sexual expression is to be limited only to marriage? This is what I call kind of a soft totalitarianism, that every aspect of life will be subjected to public agencies of one kind or another, professionals who will decide what is best for people.
Is this the same thing as what some have called the nanny state?
Yes. And here, the history of the Democratic Party is useful. It starts out, of course, back at the time of the New Deal exclusively on economic issues. It's Social Security, it's retirement programs, it's workman's compensation, it's minimum wage. And this is where the masses of people who were socially conservative would support the Democratic Party decade after decade because they would say, well, yes, I'm an underdog, I need economic help, they're offering me economic help. But the nanny state inevitably moves then from looking after your economic welfare to claiming responsibility for your general welfare. And basically, in a way, it comes down to saying how you should think. And there's a kind of an almost imperceptible movement in that direction, and we're dealing with it right now.
You have also written, late in your article in Touchstone magazine, liberalism has become a rival faith to traditional religion. How can you say this?
Well, because, of course, in what liberalism as it's now defined is in stark opposition to traditional religion on particularly sensitive moral questions. Again, abortion, homosexuality, the sanctity of marriage. These are the sacredness of human life, because not only abortion, but also euthanasia, cloning, any number of other things, where there's just a stark opposition between what is now liberalism and traditional religious teachings. But the thing, other thing is this, liberalism is a political ideology which is embraced by many people with religious fervor. What is it you really believe in? Well, I really believe in the liberal political agenda, and that's what I would die for. That's what I will go to the wall for. That is the ultimate purpose of existence. And if you want to have other religious beliefs, okay, but you better privatize those. That's been true, I think, for a long time. I think that liberalism, for a lot of people, functions equivalently as a religion.
Dave is calling from his cell phone. Dave, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. A question that I have is, the left seems to like to throw around the term religious right as kind of a scare tactic. I've never had anybody successfully define that for me that uses that term. So just wondering what your thoughts were on it.
Dave, thank you very much. Dr. Hitchcock.
Well, there's no question that it's kind of used as a smear term. I think it does describe a reality. If we say people who say, well, I'm strongly opposed to abortion because that's against my religious beliefs. I believe strongly in the family. I want to make sure that the government reflects correct values in its laws and its policies. I want to elect people to office who share my beliefs. Okay, that's the religious right. There's nothing wrong with that, except it is used as a smear word, and there is no comparable emphasis, as I said before, on the idea of the religious left.
Dave, if you will email me at twilken, that's T-W-I-L-K-E-N, I've written something very briefly where I try and define, I can email it back to you, I've tried to define the religious right. It's twilken@kfuo.org, and Wilken is spelled W-I-L-K-E-N. Let's go back to Craig, who's calling from his car. Craig, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, guys. Before I entered the ministry for 7 years, I worked for the Republican Party in California, Arizona. And I saw the party go downhill when they started being inclusive with what they called the Big Tent Party. Since I entered the ministry, I was out in Connecticut, and the Republicans acted like Democrats. Now I'm in the middle of Missouri, where the Democrats act like Republicans. And it's frustrating for me to figure these people out, because here I have staunch Democrats on my hands that are pro-life, pro-family, anti-homosexual marriage, and so forth and so on, and yet they insist on being staunch Democrats, even though they don't believe anything that their party pushes.
All right, let's see if we can sort that out, Dr. Hitchcock. We've only got a few minutes here.
A very good question, and it is an important, but I think it's a diminishing factor. There is a certain amount of tradition in all of this. My pappy was a Democrat. My grandpappy was a Democrat. I'll be one, too. There is this sentimental view of the Democratic Party as the party of the common people, as we were saying before. I think, frankly, that there are a number of people like this who kind of have to be almost schizophrenic in their point of view. I think the only way they can justify it is to say, well, I'm working to change the party, which is fine, but at some point you have to ask yourself, am I succeeding, and is there a realistic chance of succeeding? Otherwise, I think the Democrats are still drawing on this kind of residual loyalty, which goes back to the era of the New Deal, and there's a real divide between this sentimental attachment and the reality.
With less than 1 minute, as a Roman Catholic, do you think that more Roman Catholics will start voting Republican?
They have been for some time, and it's a little bit hard to know how. I mean, for what reason? So I think abortion clearly has got a lot to do with it, and there have been a number of Catholics who have said so publicly. It's also true that Catholics have been rising in the economic scale, and the tendency then is to become more Republican. Catholics would have been at one time almost a delivery vote for the Democratic Party, and that day is long past. Catholics are now a definite swing vote, and can often, I think, could in a very close election make the crucial difference, and they have certainly been drifting away from the Democratic Party.
Dr. James Hitchcock, thank you so much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Always enjoy being here.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University, senior editor of Touchstone Magazine, and author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone titled Political Orphans, How the Democratic Party Left Traditional Believers Behind. Folks, Easter is less than 2 weeks away. Can you believe that? It's coming up on the 20th of April. You'll need to hurry up and place your order this week for our Issues Etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter. Now, if you'd like to receive this book before Easter without paying any additional shipping charges, you'll need to order it by this Thursday. That's Thursday this week, April the 10th. This is the perfect Easter gift for your children, your godchildren, your grandchildren, and your family. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, beautifully illustrated by Frank Ordaz. You can order the book tonight online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book, The Very First Easter. The website address again, issuesetc.org. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When you call or when you write, ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer. It costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Order if you want it before Easter. Order this before this Thursday, April the 10th, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. There is definitely a tension here, no doubt about it, between those who have been on the political spectrum, Democratic most of their life, and they find themselves isolated by their party. They say, well, maybe the natural home of the traditional believer is the Republicans. Well, I don't know if that's true either. I don't think Christians ought to be looking for their home in either political party. I think they ought to be looking for their home in, well, where our real citizenship and commonwealth is, with Christ in heaven. Tomorrow on the program, Democrats and Abortion, we'll talk with Nat Henthoff of The Village Voice. We'll talk about the trials of Jesus with Dr. Paul Meyer, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for April. And we'll do part one of a four-part weekly series on understanding the end times with Kim Riddlebarger of the White Horse Inn. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.